We've all seen over these last couple weeks and months stories of heroes who risk their lives to help other people, and not even over the last couple months. We've seen this happening in our culture for a long time. In the wake of COVID-19 especially, we've seen nurses and doctors, paramedics, EMTs, police officers, firefighters, everyday heroes who risk serving even though they could have contracted the virus, and some did. If you remember back to 9/11, how many of you remember back to 9/11? It just seems like it was yesterday, but boy, oh boy, it's getting further and further back there. You remember the pictures of the firefighters, the police officers who rushed into those buildings to try and save people, even knowing that they were going to probably perish or die, just in the hope of getting a few others out of the building. We've seen people rush into fires, rush into gunfire to save others. We've seen right now, and this is sort of sad, we need to remember this, our military is still active. Right, Stephanie? Oh, Stephanie doesn't want to. Amen. I heard that, Steph. Okay. Her husband's overseas. He's over in the Middle East somewhere. Our military's still active, and COVID's taken the news press now, but they're over fighting a war that's become silent in our media and the military movements around the world. Guys who are laying their life on the line to keep our freedoms going, they are everyday heroes as well. And the question I have is, why do we celebrate heroes? Why do we celebrate these people? And I think some of the reason being is because I think in our culture we've become so selfish that when we see somebody display an act of selflessness, when we see somebody lay down their life even for somebody else, it impresses us. We're like, wow, that's the way I wish I could be. That's the way I wish I was, when they lay down their self-interest to help someone else. The last topic in our series, Love Like Jesus, we've been walking through this neat series of just looking at how Jesus loved people and how he taught us to love people, is probably the hardest topic for us to embrace, and it's the topic we're going to chew on a little bit this morning. If we are going to love like Jesus, then we must be self-giving and self-sacrificing. In fact, this was one of the main agenda items on Jesus' teaching list. Whoever finds their life will lose it, and whoever loses their life for my sake, they'll find it. Jesus' idea on living a self-sacrificial life seems to run almost counterintuitive or counterculture to who we are as a people today. But it's the kind of life that Jesus calls us to. So let's just review really quick. Love like Jesus. What have we talked about so far? If we're going to love like Jesus, first we need to be mindful. In other words, we need to be on the lookout for people who are hurting, for people who have needs, and we have to be mindful of who we are and what's going on inside of us, because if we're so distracted inside, we'll never be able to see somebody else's needs. So we need to be mindful of that. We need to be approachable. If we're going to love like Jesus, people need to know that we're approachable, that they're welcome around us. And it was interesting, the story on that Sunday was when the disciples were pushing the little kids away, what did Jesus do? He welcomed them. He said, let those little kids come. Let them hang out with me. Let them be near me. He also welcomed people that weren't in the popular crowd of the day, people like Zacchaeus, people like Matthew, who were tax collectors. And he welcomed them in as well. And he showed his friends self-sacrificial love by going to their home and sacrificing his agenda to go over to Zacchaeus' house, of all people, a hated tax collector. If we're going to love like Jesus, we must be graceful. We need to loosen up, church. We need to loosen up. We need to be less concerned about the rules and more concerned about giving grace to people who really need it. People who need it most. Jesus was only stringent. If you look at Jesus' life, he was only stringent about the rules with the rule keepers. He wasn't stringent with the rules with people who really needed love and needed grace. Those people, he let the rules slide a little bit so he could show them grace, still expecting them to step up to the plate, but also being graceful. And we learned in order to do this, we must learn to allow ourselves, or we must come to a place ourselves of being, not being so part of the victimization culture. And I mentioned that during the service. Parents, if you want to do a favor for your kids, teach them not to be a victim, but to be responsible for their lives. We live in a culture where we're a victim of everything. My parents' fault. It's the government's fault. Our government's our daddy. They should take care of us and they're not. You know, and we live in a culture of victimization. And if you want to live like Jesus, we need to raise up. We need to be responsible for ourselves. And we need to shake the dust of victimization off of our shoes and walk away from that. We cannot be filled with grace. We cannot show grace to others if we do not take responsibility for our own actions, our own attitudes, and our own lives. And then the last Sunday before I left for a little time off was be bold. We have to learn to be bold. And in this lesson, we learned that we need to be honest about ourselves and honest with other people about how I'm feeling and what I'm thinking. And so often in our culture, we're so concerned about what everybody else thinks of us, we don't actually speak truth anymore. We speak quasi-truth to others because we don't want to rock the boat. We don't want to make somebody mad. We don't want somebody cutting off a relationship with us. Now, it's speak the truth in love, so you don't just go hammer people. Oh, pastor said I can tell you, you're a jerk. No, that's not what I'm saying, okay? But we need to do it in love, but we need to be bold. We need to be people who stand for truth and stand for what we actually feel and be honest about that with ourselves and with others. And this then leads us to sort of the pinnacle, the crescendo of one of Jesus' biggest teaching, and that is that we're to be self-giving. The concept has actually ran through all of these other concepts in little ways, and it's coming to this big crescendo. In music, a crescendo is a thing that looks like this. And a crescendo is the loudest the music gets, and that's where this comes this morning. All of these little steps along the way have been leading to this big one, and Jesus calls us to a life of self-giving, of selflessness. So, let me just ask you a question. Are you a selfish person? Now, it's interesting. If you ask the church that question, I would say probably most people in the church would say, no, I'm not selfish. No way, I'm not selfish. Now, what's interesting is if you ask just popular culture outside the church, most people outside the church will say the same thing. No, I'm not selfish. Well, a few years ago, New York Times did a little study, and this is sort of fascinating. They surveyed a whole bunch of people, you know, like big groups can do. They grabbed a whole bunch of people together, and they asked this big group of people, are you selfish? And 17% of that group said, no, we're not selfish. But it was interesting because New York Times then asked a second question. And the second question is, do you believe other people are selfish most of the time? And 60% of that same group said, most of culture is selfish. Most other people are selfish most of the time. So I think we have a little bit of a disparity here, a little bit of denial going on. I'm not selfish, but everybody else is selfish. Now, how many would sort of agree with that? I'm not selfish, but there's a lot of people around me that are really selfish. Come on, let me see your hands. How many would actually say, yeah, I think that's true? Are y'all too scared to vote on that one? Okay. So what is it? Are we selfish or are we not selfish? You know, where do we fall here? Here's another startling truth. When considering being totally selfless, never looking to your own interests but only to the interests of others, most people would not understand why in the world would even want to do that. Why would you want to be totally selfless? That doesn't make sense, you know. How are you supposed to be happy? How are you supposed to have stuff, you know? How in the world could we possibly live like Mother Teresa and follow the American dream? That doesn't fit our culture. Can't do that. How could I have the house? You know, I'm supposed to provide for my family. It means I have to have a nice car. I have to have a nice home. I have to have a good job. I have to get ahead in life. How could you be selfish? See, so in our culture, in our mindset, sometimes we go to this place. How could I be selfless and actually have the things I'm supposed to have? You know, to do the things I'm supposed to do. It doesn't compute. It doesn't make sense. How could I have a happy life if I'm being selfless, worrying about everybody else's happiness rather than my own? Well, consider psychologist Bernard Rimland and what he went through. He earned his PhD at Pennsylvania State University, so just across the border over in Pennsylvania there. And his career was on fast track, and then 3 years into his career, he got sidetracked. His wife gave birth, but they had a son. His name was Mark. And at a very early age, they discovered something wrong with Mark, and they didn't know what was wrong. And this is way back in the 1950s. And what they diagnosed Mark with was this little-known disease called autism. In fact, Dr. Bernard didn't even know what the word was, so he had to go look it up, and he had to study what autism was. And he began to do research in around 1956. And he began to study in on this word called autism, this disease, this problem called autism. And he began, through his research, he began to write books and literature. And eventually, he became the foremost scholar on autism, and actually probably wrote a lot of the books that you might have read. If you've read anything on autism, they'll refer back to him. And he started this little institution called the Autism Institution, way back in the 1960s when nobody was understanding this stuff. In order to do that, he left his career path and he became a professor so he'd have time to do research. And as he was teaching, he decided to do a little experiment. Professors, you know, they can have fun in their classes. And so he did this little experiment in 1967. And what he did is he asked his class to simply write down 10 people that you know really well. Just mark their initials down on a piece of paper. And this is through several classes. And so 216 some students did this with him. And then he asked them a question. He said, would you indicate whether this person seems to be happy or not happy? So just go through and mark happy, not happy next to each of those 10 people. And then he asked one final question. He said, go through the list again and now mark whether they are selfish or unselfish by your perspective. So by your viewing, if it's grandma, grandpa, mom, dad, whoever, just look at them, and from your perspective, do they seem to be selfish or unselfish? And here's what his research uncovered. A striking result. 70% of those who judged unselfish seemed to be happy, while 95% of those who seemed to be selfish seemed to be unhappy. In fact, Rimlin was so surprised by the paradox, he wrote this. I've got it on the screen if you want to look at it. Selfish people are, by definition, those whose activities are devoted to bringing themselves happiness. Yet, at least as judged by others, these selfish people are far less likely to be happy than those whose efforts are devoted to making others happy. This finding begins to get at the saying that Jesus repeated about more than anything else. It ran through all of his ministry. It goes back to a saying that he instituted back 2,000 some years earlier than this. Whoever finds his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life will find it. It flips our intuitive sense of self-interest inside out. It gets at why Jesus was so radical about learning to give ourselves to others. The best way to pursue and find happiness in your life is not to go after your own happiness, but actually to seek the happiness of other people, to be selfless. If we're going to love like Jesus, we must set others ahead of ourselves. We must seek to fulfill others' agendas and needs. And in fulfilling their needs, we will begin to find what Jesus said true. We will find happiness. Well, as I've been doing with each of these sermons, we're going to go back and we're going to take a look at Jesus' life. What was it that he did? How did he live this out? What did he teach about this? And so the first verse that I want to take you to is Matthew chapter 5, verse 41 and 42. And this is from the Sermon on the Mount. So if you're very familiar with the Bible, Jesus started his ministry with this big sermon. It takes three chapters in Matthew 5, 6, and 7. And he teaches a bunch of teachings in this. And I've heard this verse hundreds of times before. You've probably heard this verse too, and maybe you heard this at the gym with your workout coach, okay? But here's the word. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. Now, what's the popular phrase that we have today that is right from this verse? Go the extra mile. Go the extra mile. They went the extra mile. You know, we use it in sports. We use it when we're working. You know, they went the extra mile. Well, this is where that comes from. Someone forced you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Now, when I was researching this week, I ran into something that fascinated me, because you read things like this in the Bible and you just sort of flip right through them like, oh, that's interesting. Okay, that makes sense. You know, go the extra mile. But when you put it in culture, you understand what's going on. What Jesus was saying here was radical. And here's why it was radical. There was a Roman law that required all young boys. So Lucas, Ethan, pay attention here. All young boys had to carry any Roman soldier's backpack and gear for 1 mile from their house, their front door of their house. The Romans did this to give reprieve for their soldiers, give a break for their soldiers. So if I'm a soldier and I'm coming into town and I come up and I see Ethan running around at his house, I come over, Ethan, you know, I don't know your name, kid, get over here, you know. And he takes all of his stuff off, his sword and all of his heavy gear, and he puts it on Ethan, and Ethan, little Ethan, would have to carry that. This is Roman law. They'd be in big trouble. His family would be in big trouble if Ethan didn't do this. So dad might even get involved. And they would carry it for 1 mile. Hi, Linda. Camera people. She's like, oh, you move too much. Here's what was happening. So Ethan, he would know this was going to happen. So Ethan, the kids started to get smart. And they would fashion little markers, stone, little wood markers, whatever, and they would carefully measure out exactly one mile from their house. And they would drive that stake into the road or set up that little group of stones, and they would know exactly where 1 mile was from their door front. And so when a Roman soldier came knocking on the door and said, Ethan, carry my stuff, Ethan would carefully walk the 1 mile, and as soon as he got to his marker, I'm done, and run back to the house. All the little Jewish boys were doing this. In fact, anywhere Rome was going, all the little boys were doing this. So all along all these roads, you got to picture this, along all these roads are little stakes. Now, how many of you see little white crosses all along our highways? People saw those, see those? And what's that mean? Well, not those, the little white crosses. You seen them along the highways? Yellow ribbons? What is it? Somebody had an accident there, probably died. They're marking something. Okay, now you know what I'm talking about? And so these little stakes from these kids were everywhere. And so as you're walking a Roman road, you're like, oh, there's, I wonder whose house that is. That's a mile from somebody's house there. This was all over the place. And so when Jesus said this, when he mentioned these words, it was radical. He says, if someone forces you, and he's specifically thinking about the Roman soldiers, if someone forces Ethan to carry the gear 1 mile, what's Jesus say to do? Carry it how many? Two. What's he telling us to do? Go the extra mile. Go 2 miles. Do what's more than expected. And here's something that I just want to mention to you. You don't do that for people you just like. He's telling us to do that for people we hate. You know, it's easy to go the extra mile for somebody you love, right? It's easy to go the extra mile for your kids. It's easy to go the extra mile, hopefully, for your wife or your husband. But is it easy to go the extra mile for the boss that you can't stand? The neighbor that throws their clippings on your side of the lawn? Is it easy to go that extra mile for a relative that just drives you batty? And that's what Jesus is saying. That's why this is radical. Jesus is saying, you go the extra mile when it's not expected. Because a Roman soldier, so you have a kid. Could you imagine Ethan? He hits the mile marker, and the Roman soldier's like, man, my time's up. I'm going to have to take my gear back. And then Ethan says, nah, we'll go another mile. What? A Roman soldier would be floored. But that's what Jesus is saying. Go the extra mile when it's not expected. Even with people that you don't like, that's how you love like me. If you just go the extra mile for somebody you like, that's big deal. But it's a big deal when you go the extra mile for somebody you don't really like. A little bit later in the same thing, in the same series or sermon, Jesus said something else. Ask yourself what you want people to do for you, then grab the initiative and do it for them. Anybody ever heard that one? There's another way of putting that. Do to others as you would have them do to you. It's a little more classical translation. And it's been called the golden rule. The golden rule. Do to others as you'd have them do to you. And what's interesting is that Jesus asked us, before Confucius and everybody else, Jesus asked us to do what you would expect or hope that other people would do for you. On another occasion, Jesus made it even more succinct, and he said, love your neighbor as yourself. Back later in Matthew, I think Matthew 23, love your neighbor as yourself. So enough said, right? We're to love our neighbors as ourselves. We're to love other people, to be self-sacrificing, self-giving. And it comes down to actively treating others the way that we want to be treated. It's how we leverage our natural self-interest to fuel loving other people appropriately. And it's genius. We all want respect. We all want love. We all want hugs. We all want certain things. And so Jesus says, the very things you want, do to other people. So we're going to have a little bit of an experiment here. So you ready? We need to get a little active. We need to prepare for communion because you're all going to have to move for communion a little bit, okay? I think it's awesome because Caitlin and Debbie already lived this out this morning. So thank you, Caitlin. You did it and I didn't even tell you. All right? I need you to do something. We're going to experiment here. I need you to look to the person on your right or to your left, whoever you're sitting next to. Okay, just look at them, get their picture, get their face in your mind. Families, you can do it too. Kids, you can do it too. And now here's what I'd like you to think. Just think, don't say it, just think. What would you like that person to do for you before you get in the car and leave the property this morning? What would you like them to do for you? Would you like them to give you a handshake? Would you like them to give you a hug? Would you like to tell them thank you? Would you like to hear a, I love you, Miss Debbie, I miss you, Miss Debbie? Is that what you would like to hear from them? Here's another one. I would like the person next to me to listen to my story without interrupting with their story. We all like to tell stories. I'd just like them to listen to my story. That's what I'd like this person to do. I would love it. You know, maybe your husband or wife sitting next to you, and you would just like your husband or wife to say thank you. For once, you know, thank you for noticing that I did the laundry or that I mowed the lawn or that I didn't burp in public or fart in public. You know, just once would you do that, you know, okay? What would you like the person next to you to do before you leave? Now, here's Jesus' ingenious idea. Whatever it is that you just put in your head, I would like to challenge you to do that for that person before you leave the building this morning. Little experiment. Jesus thought that this is ingenious. Exactly what you want another person to do for you, do for them instead. Flip it around. Let your natural self-interest guide you in this. If you long to hear from your husband or wife a simple, I love you, do that this morning to them. Not expecting a return. I
told you I love you and you never tell me.
No, that doesn't count. You know, okay? Really, just do it for them. No strings attached, no nothing back. I'm doing this because, you know what, that's what I'd love, but I'm going to do this for you. I'm going to give this to you. I'm going to listen to your story. That's a tough one, isn't it? I'm not going to tell you about all my stories. I'm just going to listen to your story this morning. Okay, so let's now, so these are some, these are little pieces that Jesus was littering all the way through his years of ministry, and now we're going to come to the end of his ministry. So we're going to camp here a bit this morning. We're going to jump to the end of Jesus' life. And we need to travel back to the book of John chapter 13, so way in the back of John, back to 13. If you have your Bibles, you can open it up. I want to read right out of my Bible this morning as well. Jesus has now lived and taught a life of selflessness. He's lived it out before the disciples. He lived it out as he sacrificed his agenda to go over to Zacchaeus' house when he had 100 other places to go. He's lived it out when they threw a half-naked lady before him and said, Jesus, they didn't believe Jesus was God at that point, but you know Jesus helped make the rules of the Old Testament. And the Old Testament rules dictated this lady be stoned, and Jesus lived it out as he showed grace rather than condemnation to this lady. He lived it out when he welcomed hated people like Matthew and Levi and different tax collectors. He invited those guys to be part of his partners in ministry. He was living it out constantly throughout his ministry, living it out when lepers came and wanted healed, and rather than running away, scared over the diseased people, he said, nah, I'll come and I'll touch you and I'll heal you and I'll hang out with you. Jesus was constantly living this out, and now it comes to the end of everything. And he sort of wraps up. So this is sort of like the crescendo on Jesus' whole ministry. Listen to this story, and I'm not going to comment on it much. I just want to read it to you. John 13, I'm going to pick up with verse 1. It was just before the Passover feast. And Jesus knew that the time had come for him to leave this world and go to his Father. And having loved his own who were in the world, he now showed them the full extent of his love. Now, don't jump ahead 2 days. Stay in the moment. He shows them the full extent of his love by what's going to happen right next. The evening meal was being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. And Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under his power, and that he had come from God and he was returning to God. So he got up from the meal, took off his outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around his waist. After that, he poured water into a basin, and he began to wash his disciples' feet, drying them with the towel that was wrapped around him. He came to Simon Peter, who said to him, "Lord, are you going to wash my feet?" And Jesus replied, "You do not realize now what I am doing, but later you'll understand." "No," said Peter, "you shall never wash my feet." And Jesus answered, "Unless I wash you, you have no part with me." "Oh, then, Lord," Simon Peter replied, "not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well." And Jesus answered, No. "A person who has had a bath needs only to wash his feet, and his whole body is clean. And you are clean, though not every one of you." For he knew who was going to betray him, and that was why he said, "not every one of you." When he had finished washing their feet, he put on his clothes and returned to his place. What a picture of service. Had nothing to do with dirty feet, did it? Had everything to do with, I'm going to do the worst job in this house because it needs done, and I'm going to serve you by doing it. The crescendo of Jesus' ministry. Whoever wants to find their life, they'll lose it. But whoever wants to lose their life for my sake, they'll find it. Those who seek their own happiness will never be happy. Those who seek the happiness of others, they'll find true happiness. If we are to love like Jesus, we must learn the secret of putting others first. Way back when I was in high school or elementary school, junior, I don't know, I was way back there. The older I get, the foggier that stuff becomes. I learned an acronym for JOY. Probably you've heard this pithy little acronym as well, but it's so true. JOY. Jesus first, others second, yourself last. If you really, and there's a lot of truth to it, if you really want to have a joyful life, if you want to capture joy, put Jesus first, put others before yourself, and then look to your own needs. And here's the miracle, here's the mind-blowing truth of this. When you put Jesus first and you start to put others first, guess what the miracle is? God takes care of you and brings you unbelievable joy. Neat little pithy phrase, neat little pithy acronym for joy: Jesus, others, and then yourself. Well, Jesus' final act of love was through communion is a great reminder of how we are to love others. The ultimate act of love came the day or so later. After he washed the disciples' feet, he went out into the garden, he was praying, then the soldiers came, he went through all the trials and stuff, and then they ended up crucifying Jesus. So he washes the feet, they have the dinner, they do the Passover, and as they're in that process, Jesus then institutes what we now call the Lord's Supper or communion. And he gave this to us, and I believe he gave this to us not just to remind us of his sacrifice and remind us of what he was going to do for us, but he also did this. Remember, everything Jesus did was to help us know how to do life. And so he gave us this communion idea to remind us that the secret to life is in giving your life away. The secret of happiness and joy and peace and contentment, all that other stuff that comes with the Christian life, all that comes as you learn to be selfless rather than selfish. And Jesus turns all of humanity on its head. And so he institutes this idea of communion, and by this reminder, he's reminding all of us every time we take communion. He was perfectly and ultimately selfless to the point that he gave his own life for us. And every time you take communion, we should be reminded that's how we should live as well. And just to put this in a little bit of perspective, sometimes we can move through communion and move through this, and we sort of forget the perspective that's going on here. For the littlest sin, the Bible tells us the wages of sin is death. For the littlest sin, every one of us deserves death. And it's not just, you know, death. It's eternal damnation. It's eternal separation from God. It's hell. That is the price of sin. Now, let me just ask you a little question here. How many of you have ever sinned? If you didn't just raise your hand, you just did. Okay. We all did. And I don't know about you, but I know about my life. I've packed a lot of those sins into my life. And for every one of those, I deserve punishment. And Jesus showed his love for us. He showed us the extent of his selflessness by saying, I will take your punishment for you. I'll take it. And it wasn't just, you know, we think this was horrible, and it was. Death on a cross was horrible, to be beat up and your skin ripped off and the crown of thorns, and it was a gruesome, awful experience that he went through. But I think the worst part about the whole crucifixion was a little phrase in there where God turned his eyes from his own son. The punishment of sin is separation from God. Jesus could have never taken that punishment if God didn't have to turn his eyes. And for a moment in time, which I believe for Jesus probably felt like an eternity, for a moment in time when he took all of our sin upon him, God had to say, I have to look away. I can't even look at my son right now. And Jesus, for that moment of time, stood separated from the Father. And he did that for you and for me. And every time I sin, every time I tell a lie, every time I hurt somebody, every time I do something I know I should not do, Jesus has taken that punishment. Took it upon himself so that I wouldn't have to take it. My friends, that's grace. Unbelievable grace. And getting ready, preparing the disciples for what he was about to do in this incredible selfless sacrifice. He said this, when the hour came, this is the story, when the hour came, Luke chapter 22, I'll give you the reference here, Luke 22, when the hour came, Jesus and his apostles reclined at the table, and he said to them, I have eagerly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer, for I tell you, I will not eat it again until it finds fulfillment in the kingdom of God. And after taking the cup, he gave thanks and said, take this and divide it among you, for I tell you, I will not drink again from the fruit of the vine until the kingdom of God comes. And he took bread, gave thanks, and broke it, and gave it to them, saying, this is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me. And in the same way, after supper, he took the cup, saying, this cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you. Communion reminds us of what Jesus did, and it reminds us of what we're called to do too, to be selfless, to be giving, to sacrifice our wants and desires, to raise up the wants and desires of others.